Congress is close to sealing a new deal for lowering student loan interest rates after they doubled to 6.8% on July 1st. On this week's edition of On Your Money, we'll talk with financial planner Kevin McKinley about the perils of student loans as a borrowing model and what lessons everyone can learn about debt management. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We will also talk about rising interest rates and what that means for home buyers, and just how much money do we need to retire anyway. Plus, if you have any personal finance questions, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. He joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Joy.
So what's new with you, Kevin?
I am enjoying this weather. And I've just realized that the days just started getting shorter, a mere 5 weeks ago, and so I'm trying to get as much of the sunshine as I possibly can.
It is gorgeous. I agree. And I suppose there are a number of students who are paying off student loans who are happy these days. An agreement may have been reached regarding the interest rates on those student loans?
Yes, it may have been reached, and it reinforces a warning we've made in the past and will make again. These are federal Stafford loans, PLUS loans. Previously, they typically had a fixed interest rate at the start. There's going to be a possible increase in the interest rate, and it's going to be pegged to the rate of the 10-year Treasury. For instance, if undergrads are borrowing money, they'll pay the 10-year Treasury rate, which is about 2.5% right now, plus 2%, and a cap of 8.5%. Grad students will pay 3.6% over that with a cap of 9.5%, and parents borrowing money to pay for higher education expenses will pay 4.6% over that rate with a cap of 10.5%. We still haven't received a final resolution. We won't until this fall, but it looks pretty good.
So how does this reinforce the warning?
It will never be easier to borrow in a general sense. Rates are extremely low right now. Standards are fairly accommodating from lenders. And most people who can get those very good rates, their personal situation is never likely to be better. So if you do have a big expense coming up, and especially as it refers to higher education, borrow now. People need to conquer the fear of interest rates and worry more about a fear of liquidity and not worry so much about paying interest. And if interest rates go down further, or you get in a better situation where you always have too much cash on hand, you can always pay these loans back or refinance whatsoever. But based on this and other instances, we're seeing that we may have reached a bottom in terms of being able to borrow money at such low interest rates.
What are some other examples that we've seen that are harder to get now than they were in the past?
Remember, probably 6 or 7 years ago, we never would get personal mail. All we would get was those 0% credit card offers in the mail. And all you had to do to qualify for that was to be able to open your actual mailbox, it seemed like. And those don't come around nearly as much as they used to. Mortgages, we'll talk about that later on. But mortgages are a little harder to get now, obviously, than they were in 2006 or 2007. And reverse mortgages, which we've talked about several times. There's been a change in the last year or so in how available those are. But there's going to be another one here where people who need to borrow from reverse mortgages have to start applying for credit, because a lot of people who borrowed from them in the past were they didn't have any money, but they weren't even able to pay the basic maintenance, upkeep, property taxes, and insurance of the homes on which they had placed that reverse mortgage.
So how can listeners apply this lesson to other areas of their personal financial life?
Let's start with that debt. Homeowners out there who do have a mortgage should definitely pay that mortgage down as slowly as they possibly can. Make that the last place that your dollar goes rather than your first one. And if you are in a situation where you have some established home equity, you may want to look at refinancing right now, getting 80% of the loan-to-value in a mortgage for a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage. And as we mentioned with student loans, families need to start borrowing first to pay for the first few years of school and use any savings or income last, because if interest rates do go up, the terms for those loans in the future might be higher than they are right now. And for people who are considering retiring, especially those who are looking at their pension and Social Security, they're probably better off taking what they can get today rather than delaying that money to get a higher amount down the road.
Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for every investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. That being said, if you have a personal finance question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Yes, it's time now for the On Your Money email bag, and several listeners have asked about the recent rise in interest rates and if they've missed out on their chance to get a great rate when they buy a new home, or if they refinance, or if they refinance the mortgage on their current home. Is it too late, Kevin?
Joy, what was the interest rate on the first mortgage you ever achieved?
Boy, I'm thinking it might have even been double digits.
Uh-huh.
And now it's under 3%.
Well, it's a little over that now for most people getting new mortgages. But yes, there are several people listening to us right now who jumped up and down, went out to dinner, and thanked their lucky stars that they were able to get a 30-year fixed rate mortgage at 11.5% 30 years ago. And now people are bemoaning the fact that they may have to pay 4 or 4.5%. We finally may have seen the bottom in interest rates. The current 30-year rate is about 4.5% right now. The lowest that we've seen without any points was 3.35% in May of this year. The last time we hit this 4.5% average level was about 2 years ago. But people who are thinking about either buying a home or refinancing should definitely not let this little bump up get them discouraged.
Yeah, why not?
Well, for buyers, first of all, rising interest rates on mortgages generally lead to falling prices in homes. Now, maybe not the specific home you're looking at, but in general, you have a little bit more leverage on the price of a home if the interest rates have gone up, and it can even make the payments the same. Let's say you were looking at getting a $100,000 30-year mortgage at 3.5%. The monthly payment on that would have been about $450. And now let's say you look at this and say, oh gosh, it's gone to 4.5%. Well, getting a $95,000 mortgage at 4.5% for 30 years will still give you about $480 in payments. So yes, rates may have gone up a whole percentage point, but if the price has gone down a little bit, the mortgage won't go up very much. And even if you can't get the price down at all, the new 4.5% interest rate on a $100,000 mortgage will give you a payment of $506 versus $450 at the previous low. So it's more money, and it's, you know, $600 a year per $100,000 borrowed. But it's not something that should be the difference between buying the house and not buying the house.
Right, and refinancers can't benefit from falling prices, can they?
Generally not, and they can even be hurt a little bit by it if the appraisal is predicated on those prices and the prices have gone down, therefore driving the appraisal down. But they still may be wise to refinance now rather than wait, even if they're paying a little bit higher interest rate. They might be getting a much higher valuation now on the home than they would have, say, 2 years ago or a year ago, and their personal situation might be better as well, so they could afford a better interest rate from the lender. And again, look at 30-year mortgage, try to get 80% of the loan to value, and then even if you have no need for the extra cash, or the cash that you need is less than 80%, you might still want to consider pulling that cash out of the mortgage as well.
What should I do with that cash?
Well, like any power tool, you should use it wisely and safely and appropriately. You may want to pay off debt that you have that's at a high interest rate, like credit card debt. You may want to save more into a pre-tax plan at work, like a 403B or a 401K. And you might want to just tuck it aside in a savings account for emergencies that might come up, or paying for future big expenses like a car or college education, or if you have some a fear of incurring some uncovered health care expenses. It's better to get it now, park it aside, pay a little interest on it, and have it there when you need it rather than have it not be there when you need it.
Coming up on this edition of On Your Money, just how much money do we need to retire anyway? And we will finish up our long road trip talking about cars over the past several weeks, and we'll talk about a way to pay for a car that is growing in popularity as On Your Money continues. But we also have plenty of room for your questions. If you have a money matter, a personal finance question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Let's go to Dave in Madison first. Hi, Dave.
Good morning, Joy.
Good morning.
Morning, Kevin.
Hi, Dave.
Thanks for taking my call. Listen to the program frequently whenever I can, including this morning. I have a question about funding college for children. I've got two small children, 4 and 6, so I've got a little bit of time here.
Wait, what are their names?
Yeah, number 4 and number 6.
Okay, good, fine.
Yeah, it keeps it easy for me to remember who's who that way. We do have a 529 started, but my question is it, you know, with regard to strategy for saving for retirement and college, you know, my understanding is that putting money into a 529 kind of works against the child if they want to get loans out for college. And maybe I'm wrong on that, so please straighten me out. Does it make more sense to put that money into my own retirement account, 401k, those types of things, which don't necessarily go against the child being able to take out loans for college?
Yeah, you have you're barking up a tree. It's just not the right tree. You've got the right sense, but it's for the wrong reason. You're better off saving for retirement than you are saving for college, because you can borrow money to pay for college, as we've been talking about today, but you cannot borrow money to retire. So in the hierarchy of savings, I would prefer that in a situation like yours, you would save all that you can for retirement first, and do that by maxing out any pre-tax retirement plans that you have, like a 401k or a 403b, and then save in Roth IRAs for yourself and your spouse or the parent of the children. And the reason being is that you can pull the contributions back out of the Roth IRA whenever you want with no taxes or penalties whatsoever. So those can be used as kind of an ersatz hybrid college retirement savings vehicle. And if you get a bunch of money in retirement and you don't need it, and you can help pay for college, you can pull all that money out of the Roth IRA tax-free on the contribution portion. And then finally, only if you have money left over above and beyond all that should you use 529 plans. 529 plans are better for people who are saving for another child who's not their own, like a grandchild or a nephew or something. And they're also very good if you're saving everything else you've maxed out. There's nothing else you can do and you're just building up cash. They can provide a nice little tax break. But otherwise, start with retirement first. Max out all of those options. You'll probably qualify for more need-based financial aid than you will with a 529 plan. Although 529 plans can have some favorite status as well. So don't ignore them completely, but just don't make them a priority.
Great. Thank you. Have a great day.
All right, Dave. Thanks very much. That made a lot of sense, Kevin.
Yeah. Do you think he now has stopped listening to the show that he got his question?
That's right. I think so. He's gone. He hung up right away. We are talking about your money. Kevin McKinley has information and advice on your money, as he does just about every week at this time. And we still have room for you if you have a question at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network. You are listening to On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine with certified financial planner Kevin McKinley. If you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Our next caller is Benjamin in Lodi. Hi, Benjamin. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a question about first-time home buying and a kind of a complicated situation. But I'm a graduate student. I'll be finishing in December, and I'm taking a job in Washington State where I'll be there for at least 5, probably more like 10 or 15 years. And my goal after I'm done in Washington is to come back to Wisconsin, and I want to purchase a larger farm, which I imagine will be I'll be needing a big loan for that. So my goal coming out of Washington is to have saved up and earned as much money as I possibly can. So for my 5 or 10 years there in Washington. I'm wondering, is it going to be a good idea to try and purchase a home and make that investment, or would it be better? Would I be better off just renting and trying to live as cheap as I can while I'm out there?
Benjamin, that's a great question. Have you considered commuting?
No, I don't think I have enough time to.
Okay, right. Because you would be you'd be going with traffic the whole way, so it'd be bad. You're just about on the borderline for renting versus owning. If you were going to be there any shorter period of time, I would say, you know what, just rent, find the nicest place you can, have little or no overhead, and increase your savings so whenever you're ready to go, you got a big chunk of money to put down. It's still anything within 5 years, and especially when interest rates are fairly low, and I don't see a huge boom in the housing market in prices for the foreseeable future. Anything less than 5 years, I'd say definitely rent. If it's 5 to 10 years, you're probably on the fence in terms of making money. But the problem is that if interest rates go up, you're probably going to lose some value, some equity on that home, unless you've really lucked out and got something in a good area, or that you get for a steal. And also, you're going to have a lot of maintenance that's just going to clobber you, not just financially, but every time you have to replace the furnace or put a new roof on for $20,000, you're going to say, oh, geez, this is money that could have gone for my dream, which is a farm back in God's country here. So if you can stand it, I would say rent. I, for the length of time you're saying, and as long as you can promise to stay just in one place while you're out there, it may be okay to buy, especially with mortgage payments being what they're being. I think you could probably accumulate some equity over that time period. But run one of those mortgage calculators sometime, and you'll be very disappointed watching the principal go down so slowly for the first 5 or 10 years. They'll run about, put a link up at onyourmoney.com for a calculator you can use, but they show you the balance of the loan every single year. And when you see that, you'll see that in the first 5 to 10 years, you're really only paying interest on the loan. It's not until you've been in the place for at least 7 to 10 years before you really start eating away at the principal. So you might end up having it be a wash plus being all on the hook for it. So I definitely would rent when you get out there. And then if you say, no, I really like it here and I found a place that's a good deal and that I could stay in for 10 years, I'd probably buy the place.
Okay. Awesome. Well, thanks for the advice.
Before you go, Benjamin, what are you going to raise on that future farm of yours?
Well, everything under the sun, anything that'll grow in Wisconsin, vegetables, the fruit and nut production, and animals as well. So
dandelions, I would recommend as well. Those grow really well in Wisconsin.
And they're great for salad, and they make a great wine.
They do. Benjamin, good luck. Thank you so much for the call. Kate emails, I have $60,000 in school loans from undergrad and grad school at 7/8% interest? Is that for real? Or maybe it's 7 or 8% interest. I trained as a social worker, and I'm in the process of moving to Portland and considering work as a server because the pay is the same or better than pay as a social worker. Should I prioritize paying off my loans and only my loans, or setting up a personal IRA and savings account, health account, as I most likely won't have those benefits in a serving position? How should she approach this, Kevin?
Well, she's done a tremendous service to all the people who were considering going into social work for the money. You can go into serving tables without accumulating $60,000 alone. So it's a very noble profession, but please do not do it for the money. She probably means a 7 to 8% interest.
Right.
I would say I would rather have her pay down the debt as slowly as possible in her situation and accumulate cash. And then once she has maybe 6 months to a year's worth of living expenses in some kind of fairly liquid account, like a checking or savings account, then and only then would I start paying off those loans any faster than she has to. And especially because under some of those loans, there's an income-based repayment plan option, whereas if you pay the basic minimum for a long time, based on your income, those loans may be forgiven for the remaining portion. Now, it's a long time down the road, and you still can accumulate a pretty sizable amount of debt by slowing it down, but it's a good way to get out from under that. And she can go to ibrinfo.org to find out if she has loans that would qualify for the income-based repayment plan.
1-800-642-1234 if you have a question for Kevin. You can also email us onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine with certified financial planner Kevin McKinley, and this is On Your Money. Natalie in Madison is with us next. Hello, Natalie.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I recently inherited a lot of real estate and a retirement account and some cash. I was wondering if your guest recommends that I sell the real estate or sell part of it and reinvest, or what he thinks of mutual funds, that sort of thing.
All right, guest.
Yes. I wish I had the status of guest. I'm the annoying cousin who never leaves, Natalie. I'm no guest. Trust me. Like, oh, he's here again. Jeez. Natalie, do you enjoy the prospect of being a landlord?
No.
Okay. You are right to do that. I would consider keeping the real estate only if you found a property management company who is willing to be the landlord for you and in return will probably collect about 20 to 30% of the rent. Even in that case, rental real estate can be still a nice investment if it's already paid for, if you have other assets from which to draw, so you're not relying on the rental income as well. Otherwise, I don't think there's, you know, the stock market is in the U.S. is breaking all-time highs. Interest rates are near all-time lows. I don't think there are a tremendous amount of other investments out there. So if you have other liquid assets, I probably would hang on to the real estate for the time being and enjoy the increased cash flow, because you're going to get much, you're going to net much more out of that with more hassle than you will get from any CD. And you probably have even less risk or volatility with that than you do with many stock or bond mutual funds right now. So offhand, I'd say if you can find a good property management company, I'd hang on to it. If you can't, then go ahead and sell it.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Natalie. Good luck. Tom in Milwaukee is with us now. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yes, what's your question?
Thank you for taking my call, first of all. And yes, Kevin, my question is, I'm 26. I'm a relatively young landlord. I work for my family's business in the construction industry, and I'm also a landlord, like I said, so I own two properties currently, and I've been having this debate. My father really urges me to max out my Roth every year, and my side of the debate is, instead of maxing out my Roth, perhaps I should pay off my debt, or my mortgage on my rental properties. So that way I can afford more rental properties in the future. I intend on being a landlord for the rest of my life, acquiring more properties as I, you know, as I can. So what would your advice be, to max out my Roth or to pay off my debt?
Oh, there we go. I'm going to sit back and
you're finally going to listen to one of my answers. Good. Well, this will just be fun for both of us. Tom, good for you, first of all, especially charting this course at a very young age. And you're right, and you're exactly the kind of person whom I would recommend pursue this, someone with construction background who knows how hard it is to build and maintain a property and can make those changes yourself if you see them. You're sure we're talking about a Roth, right? Not like a 401k or IRA?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay, good. My advice actually would be to go with your father, and I just want to make it clear, he did not contact me in advance and say, look, my son's calling you this morning, he's a good kid, but steer him in the right direction. Because you could, as we mentioned, you can always slide that money over from a Roth and pull the contributions back out, and the lender won't necessarily look at that accumulation of the Roth IRA unfavorably. In fact, there might be a point where you have these two paid for houses, and a lender for a new property might look at this and say, you know what? You got all this paid up houses. You have no liquid assets whatsoever. And so therefore, we're not going to be able to give you the loan, or you're not going to be able to get the loan as attractive terms as possible. And if you have the money in the Roth IRA and you need to use it to pay for a down payment, or the lender tells you that he or she wants you to slide it over and sometime and retire the debt faster, you can do it at that time. But it's more difficult to get it back out of the properties in the form of a loan, or worse yet, by selling them if you've already used it to pay off. So I would definitely recommend you keep accumulating the Roth payments every single year, but definitely go forth and multiply those properties.
Okay. And just real quick, how much in debt should I put myself with these properties?
Geez, well, the lender will tell you what's safe, but I wouldn't want you to have anything, you know, probably assume that, check on your occupancy level if they're smaller properties. You know, the good news and bad news is that they're usually easier to rent. The bad news is if there's one vacancy and it's long term, it can clobber you. So I'd want you to have, you know, maybe, at probably 80 to 90% of the ability to at that occupancy level to always make all the payments that you need. And so if you're going to go above that, if with that level of occupancy, like the renters drop down, the number of units you have filled, I'd be very cautious about taking on more units at that time.
Okay.
Hey, Tom, before you go, do you think your dad's listening?
No, I'm out of town.
Yeah,
and this morning, so
then are you going to follow Kevin's advice?
No, that's a good one. I feel bad. I lost the debate now, but thank you very much. Yeah.
Thank you, Tom. Good luck to you. I was going to say, Kevin, this is similar to that segment that we had talked about starting up a while back on, you know, let Kevin decide a personal finance debate that you're having with somebody in the family or something.
But I think it was that time I recommended that couple slice their baby in half is why we decided not to do that anymore.
Yeah, they didn't like that advice. No. But Tom, thanks for the call and good luck to you. We will take more of your calls in just a moment, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. If you have a personal finance matter that you would like Kevin's take on, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. And it is time now for Smart Assets. A recent article in the New York Times asked a question that may astonish you. Kevin?
I enjoy the New York Times quite a bit, but one of the things I enjoy about it is how completely out of touch some of these people are in terms of the rest of America. The question was, is it possible to retire with $1 million? And the fact that even has to be asked... it's not even. It's not even close. I think you should be born with $1 million rather than retire with $1 million. They made some good points in the article, but others were not so useful. They talked about the dangers of bonds and inflation, and bonds can go down in value without, you know, discussing the fact that stocks can go down and will go down usually a lot more than bonds ever will. But it gave us a chance to offer our counterpoint and offer up maybe a more hopeful formula and. Also, people for the chance to track their progress. This is one of the questions we get all the time about, can you go over, about, I want to see how I'm doing. Is there a simple formula I can use to see if I'm on track, even though I'm 20 or 25 years away from retirement?
So how do you find out if you're on track?
Well, let's answer the question first. It should be. $1 million should be enough to retire on. As a rule of thumb, take your liquid savings, if you're nearing retirement, and divide that amount by 200. And whatever number you come up with can be added to your monthly Social Security or pension check, and that's about the amount of money that you should be able to spend in retirement if you're right in your, for sure, your mid-60s, but maybe even late 50s or early 60s.
All right. Can you give us an example?
Right. Let's take a 62-year-old couple, and let's say they have $200,000 in savings, and let's say they've applied for Social Security. They're getting $2,000 per month total between the two of them. So first, we got to take that savings and divide by 200. So $200,000 divide by 200 leaves us with $1,000. So take that amount plus their Social Security checks, which were $2,000, that equals about $3,000 in monthly spending that they can come up with. Now, this may seem daunting to some people, but the average American household only spends about $4,000 per month typically. And if people take in, you know, $36,000 per year, they'll pay little or nothing in state and federal income taxes in most cases.
Yeah, so now how can we tell if we're on track to reach that number?
Well, you can take that monthly spending amount again, go back to that, and if you're in your 30s, you should have saved about 25 times that figure. So if you're spending $4,000 per month, you should have saved about $100,000 in retirement plans, CDs, checking, etc. If you're 40s, it should be 50 times that amount. If you're in your 50s, about 100 times that amount. And if you're in your 60s, again, about 200 times that amount, and then less Social Security and pension at that point. Those are benchmarks to give people an idea how they're doing. And if you come in short for that, don't feel bad. Just bump up your contributions to your at-work retirement plans and try to get that number back up. And usually the best way to build your retirement savings is not through investing aggressively. It's through saving more into those very retirement plans and accumulating it that way.
I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner, Managing Member of McKinley Money LLC. Coming up on Your Money, we will conclude our series on cars, and we'll talk about a way to pay for a car that is growing in popularity, and we'll take more of your personal finance questions. I'm Joy Cardine. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine, along with Certified Financial Planner Kevin McKinley, and it's time to finish up our long road trip over the next week or two. And today we will talk about a way to pay for a car that is growing in popularity. Kevin?
Well, it's not really paying for the car, but paying for the use of the car, kind of like long-term renting. It's leasing, and according to Experian, the credit rating agency, almost 30% of newer cars are obtained through a lease agreement. And there's some obvious disadvantages to it. You don't get to keep the car at the end of the lease. You have to keep buying them over and over if you don't keep the car. And the details of a lease can sometimes be very confusing to people, and they can lose a lot of money if they don't pay attention. But the advantages are there's a lower monthly payment than if you were to take out a loan and buy the car. You generally have to come up with little or no down payment. You get the enjoyment and reliability of buying and driving a new car that is still under the manufacturer's warranty. So you're unlikely to have a lot of expensive repairs with it. And then you don't have to sell the car when it's done. You can just give it back to the dealership. And there is an option in most leases to actually keep the vehicle and purchase it at that point. Or just say, you know what, I like driving a new car. I like having a fixed payment. I don't drive these things very long. So I'm just going to keep flipping them every 3 years.
Oh, but then I can't say that I drove my car for 15 years for nearly 200,000 miles.
That's right. You have no other accomplishment. I'm not sure what we'd even put in your obituary if you were to lease a car rather than driving yours into the ground.
Well, what kind of driver is a good candidate to lease a car?
A certain kind of person, one who has very good credit but has little or no savings to use as a down payment or to pay cash for the car, who drives a fairly predictable mileage amount, who's fairly fastidious and keeps the car in good shape, and most importantly, one who can read and decipher all the fine print of a lease agreement.
Well, no wonder I'm not a good candidate for that.
Sign here, here, and here, and then you drive away, right?
Right. But so, well, let's say, if I wanted to lease a car, what should I look for?
Well, negotiate the price of the car first with the seller before talking about leasing. And the same thing goes with trading in your vehicle as well. Only talk about leasing as a last source of paying for it rather than the first price of just getting your payment down. Look at the residual value of the car. That's the value that the dealer or the seller has put on what the car will be worth at that specific time when the lease is up. And the higher the number is, the more it's going to cost you if you do want to buy the car. But the higher the number is, the less you'll have to pay in the lease over the time that you're actually using it. Also look at and negotiate the money factor. That's the interest rate being charged on the money that you are borrowing for this shorter period of time. And it is a smaller amount, but it's still very important and it's negotiable. So ask about the money factor. Probably don't want to put too much of a down payment on the lease. And the good news is that you probably don't have to. Many leases can be had for as little as $1,000 up front with closing costs and everything. And you also have to purchase gap insurance because you are still borrowing money to purchase this car. And the value of the car may be less than, or the accident may be less than what you owe on it. And so gap insurance covers the difference between the two, and that's mandatory. And then also note any costs at the end of the lease before you sign it. Look for any trade-in, if you bring it back, any maintenance or anything, and make sure that you know what those costs are before you actually sign the lease in the beginning.
Okay, so once a vehicle is leased, then what?
Take very good care of it. Do not customize it. I think somebody else is going to have to promote coexisting or WPR with their bumper stickers or whatever, but you can't do this on this lease car. Watch your miles, and if you're getting close to your mileage limits, which are typically 12 to 15,000 miles per year, but those can also be negotiated as well. But if you are getting close to your mileage at near the end of the lease, you may want to just rent a car for longer trips or even a shorter period of time to make sure that you don't go over the mileage. And then also, if you are a one-time leaser, meaning you don't want to do this again, start accumulating money up so you at least have enough to make the down payment on a new car once the lease is done. And we'll talk a little bit about this in the future as well.
Sounds good. And if you do, though, have one of the WPR auto magnets that easily come off, you can put that on your car.
Yeah, and you can, and if they're magnets, as long as they don't, you can put 100 or 200 of those all along the body of the car. That's perfectly acceptable.
But no, don't use it as a trash bin either for your fast food wrappers.
Yeah, use other people's car for your trash.
There we go. Well, if you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Beatrice in Port Washington is with us. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, I have a question about a mortgage. I own a two-unit condominium, and in order to, I live in one side and I rent the other side. In order to buy the rental unit, I got a mortgage on my house and I got a cash out. I refinanced my mortgage and I got the cash out to the top, as much equity I had. Now my question is, so the rental unit is free of debt. My question is, should I get a mortgage in the rental unit and do I get the cash out from that, or should I just leave it free of a mortgage and debt, or what should I do?
Do you have other assets, Beatrice, besides just this rental property, like mutual funds or CDs or savings accounts?
Well, I have a little bit of the CDs. I had two kids in college, and I was saving that for, you know, expenses, and so that's what I saw. If I get the mortgage from the rental unit, then maybe I will have some more assets for college or for expenses.
Sure. I would talk to the lender and see what kind of terms you can get. Sometimes on these kinds of properties, it's hard to get a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage on it. They're more likely to give you an adjustable-rate mortgage. And if that's the case, I'd rather have you just get a home equity line of credit against those, if that's possible. And the line of credit, have you ever used one of those before, Beatrice?
No, I have not.
Okay, line of credit is a pre-established ability for you to borrow against that property whenever you want without having to file a new application for it. And it generally has an adjustable interest rate, but if you do tap the home equity line of credit, all that happens is whatever you borrow, that's all what you have to pay interest on. So let's say you have a properties that are worth $200,000 and you get a home equity line of credit on there for $50,000, and then you just tap it for $10,000 for an emergency or some other need that comes up, you only have to pay interest on the $10,000 that you actually borrow, and typically you only have to pay the interest up to a certain period of time. And even if it's 5 or 6%, that's only about, you know, maybe $40 or $50 per month interest on that $10,000, and then whenever you want to, you can pay it off. And then sometimes at some point the lender will say to you, all right, it's been 5 years on this home equity line of credit, we're going to switch this off into a fixed rate loan for you and just to keep it at a straight rate. But that's a way to tap into the equity without going through the whole process of getting the mortgage.
All right. That sounds great. I will do that.
Okay. Good luck.
Yeah. Thank you, Beatrice, for the call. But going back to earlier in the show, Kevin, just a general rule of thumb, it sounded like Beatrice might want to take out this line of credit to help pay for her kids' college costs. You would recommend they get a loan, right?
Yeah, I'd recommend she get the student loans first, even if they are the subsidized or unsubsidized loans. Get the student loans first, actual education loans, and then use the home equity line of credit if and when the loans run out or if the terms on the loans are higher than what the home equity line of credit is in the future. But use the student loans first, home equity second, and then savings last, because once the savings is used to pay for higher education expenses or anything else, it's gone. You can't go back to the school and go, remember 1988, I was a freshman, and you said you can get a loan, and I didn't get it. Well, I'd like to go back in time and get that loan. I could really use the money right now.
I get it. George in Broadhead is with us now. Hi, George.
Yeah, hi. I have a question about Parent PLUS loans. I'm 64, And in the recession, I got laid off my job. Actually, it's been about 5 years now. And I've been, I took the deferment, unemployment deferment on my student loans. I've got, for my child, I've got approximately, approximately $43,000 worth of student loans. And it's 8.5, or they average about 8%. One's 7.9, one's 8.5, whatever.
Sure.
But monthly payments would come out to $450 a month. And on Social Security, I'm making $1,100 a month. And I've got about $70,000 in my 401k. So I don't know if I should continue on deferment.
Well, sure. Well, have you talked to the lender about your options?
Yeah, but the people who answer the phone usually aren't all that knowledgeable.
Sure. Ask to speak to the supervisor and say, I want to discuss with someone my different options for this from deferment. They're very difficult to discharge. You are going to accrue interest while they're in deferment or forbearance or whatever, but see if there's an income contingent repayment plan where it can match it to your income. Sometimes they're willing to work with you on that. Sometimes it's possible to get out from under these in bankruptcy, but there are a lot of extra costs to it, and even then, it's still very difficult to get it discharged completely. If you just can't make the payments whatsoever, George, what I would do is actually talk to an attorney who specializes in bankruptcy and tell them your situation and see if it's possible to go through this. But I would start with the lender first and see what your options are. I guarantee you won't be the first person who called today with your particular situation.
Yeah, George, good luck to you. Thank you for the call. Moving now to Mark in Oconomowoc. Hello, Mark.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Pretty good. What's your question?
I would like to get an opinion on whether I should pull back my investments on the stock market with it being up as high as it is. I'm probably within 3 years of retirement. I have monies in the 401 mutual funds. And with the stock market up, I was wondering if I should take the money and run or if I should keep riding the rise of the stock market.
Hard to know for sure without knowing your situation and knowing exactly what's going to happen in the stock market. But I would tell you from doing this for 25 years or so, the transition between working and earning and saving to retiring and spending is difficult enough when things are going well in the investment world like they have in the last couple of years. It's much, much more difficult when you're seeing 20 or 30% drops in the value. So what I'd like to see you do is if you don't have enough cash set aside to cover at least a year or two of expenses, is maybe do that. And that does a couple of things. First of all, if you're right and the market is high and it's about to go down, you've preserved some cash from that decline. And the second thing is it allows you to ride out future losses because you won't be as emotionally upset by seeing the value go down when you are pulling it out, because while it's declining, you're also making it decline by living off of it. So if you say, well, I've got, you know, $50,000 in CDs or something, that's not going anywhere, and that'll cover me for a year or two, I can ride out this decline in the market and hopefully profit from it in the future.
Okay, Mark?
Okay.
Yeah. I think we might have... I'm sorry, Mark. I think we lost our connection with you. Take the Money and Run is another song we can play on the show in the future, Kevin. What do you think?
Well, I think we can just sing it. Ready? One, two. One, two.
Let's have Ruth sing it. Ruth in Milwaukee.
Yes, hi. I'm retired, and I live on my Social Security. I have a few dollars that I invested in Ginnie Mae, and one was retirement and one was a non-retirement. And it was doing well, and then suddenly the market fell out. And so I took what I had left, and I put it in prime reserve in the meantime. I don't expect to make a lot of money because my investment is small. What I wanted to do was be able to get as much interest as I could to just enhance whatever I have and use that as my cushion. And I want to know, what do you suggest?
It's a very tough environment out there right now for safe investors because safe investments pay little or nothing in interest. What I would recommend is you complement some of your other income investments with a long-term certificate of deposit that has a relatively small and knowable surrender charge if you need to pull that money out early. You can look at a couple different ones, go online. Discover Bank is one. I've got no affiliation with them, but they've had a 10-year CD that I've used for a lot of people in the past that pays close to 2%. It does have a 15-month penalty if you pull the money out early, but that gives you some safety, a little bit of income, and liquidity so that if you need the money to spend or interest rates rise and you find a better deal down the road, that's a good way to go too. But be very cautious in this environment about reaching for yield with other kinds of investments because you might make 1 or 2% more in interest. But if interest rates rise in general, the value of your investment, Ruth, can drop 10 to 15%. Giving up all of that extra gain that you would have achieved over our lifetimes. And so be very careful about relying on that extra 1 or 2% because you may be taking on a lot more risk than you're aware of.
Good luck to you, Ruth. Thank you very much for the call. Here's an email from Bill. He says, quick question. I use Mint.com and got a message that I should consider moving my student loans to a nonprofit credit union. Do you have any thoughts on this? Should that just be private loans or federal loans too? Does it depend on whether they have viable interest rates?
The credit unions are actually a good alternative, and they're not perfect, but they're better than many other, especially large banks out there, for customer service and offering specific help rather than a broader plan because they're usually smaller and they're usually more locally based. So I'm a big fan of credit unions. I would call them up and explain your situation and see what they have. Now, if it's student loans, sometimes moving them to another lender or consolidating them can change the terms of the loan and change the type of loan. And I would not do this if you have federal student loans because those are the ones that you can take advantage of that income-based repayment plan at some point in the future if you're not already. But, yeah, I definitely call up the local credit union and see what they have to say.
All right, Kevin, I think we have time now for the website of the week.
Well, we've got two of them, actually. One is swapalease.com, and the other is leasetrader.com. These are interesting because both websites help people get out of leases that they've taken out on vehicles early before the lease expires, or they offer vehicles under a new lease where you can take it over. And it's a good lesson because for people who are considering leasing, they can look at this and say, geez, you know, is this a car I would have leased, and what would have happened if I had to have gotten out of it early? Or for people who say, you know what, I need a car for about a year, or I need a good, reliable car, and I think I'm just going to go in and pick up someone else's misfortune but make a better deal off of it. So again, swapalease.com and leasetrader.com as well. And we'll put that up at onyourmoney.com later on today. And by the way, we'll also put up at onyourmoney.com that article that we had up there several months ago, but we'll put up again because we get a lot of requests where we talk about measuring your readiness for retirement based on your monthly savings and your monthly spending. And it's one of the reasons why we came up with this is because what you spend every single month is the key determinant into how well you're doing financially and how likely you are to be financially independent in the future.
Excellent. I'm heading over there after the show. Four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner. He is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC with offices in Eau Claire and in Madison. He is here just about every week at this time with information and advice on your money. Now, if you have a question for Kevin and you want it to be considered for our mailbag segment, you can email it anytime, onyourmoney@wpr.org. So thanks very much to Christy Taylor and to Justin Williams for producing and directing this program. Thanks, as always, to certified financial planner Kevin McKinley for lending us his expertise just about every week for On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.